Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name is Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting today from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today's show will air for the first time on October 17th, 2008. Well, hi, everybody. It's the fall. I can't believe it. It's October already. I don't know how the months go by so fast. And as we all know, it's been a pretty tumultuous time in the country right now. You know, that old, I think it's a Chinese curse, may you live in exciting times. Well, we are living in exciting times. We've had the financial and economic meltdown, and that on top, of course, on the collapse of our healthcare system in general. There's so much going on right now in addition to the election. It's kind of a scary time, isn't it? You know, this economic meltdown kind of reminds me of that there's similarities between that and the collapse of our healthcare system. In a way, the way people dealt with the economy and with their finances was a little bit like always suppressing symptoms and patching things up and just thinking you could keep on doing that forever when you were ignoring the fundamentals of what's underlying the problem, that you can't, you know, proceed and do questionable financial practices forever without it eventually getting back and biting you, just the same way you can't do questionable medical things and keep suppressing symptoms forever without finally getting back and biting you and causing chronic, deeper problems. And, you know, the message of homeopathy is that you need to get to the root of what's going on. Of course, in homeopathy, that's all about getting to the fundamental underlying energy disease that's going on and curing that with homeopathy. And I guess in the case of the economy, it's getting to the root as well and getting back to the basics, you know. Don't borrow money you don't have. Don't lend money you can't get back. And all the rest. So, well, if only, you know, if we could solve this crisis and learn from it and do the same with our healthcare system, that would be a wonderful thing. So, anyway, I don't know about you, but for me, and especially now heading into the dreaded flu season again, homeopathy provides a very strong sense of security. Frankly, I just don't know how my family would survive without it. I don't feel like I'm at the mercy of the U.S. healthcare system. And the cost, people sometimes complain about the cost of homeopathy, which I can never really understand. It's true that the first appointment with a homeopath is often very expensive, ranging from, you know, anywhere from like $200 to $500, depending on the homeopath, because they are spending a lot of time with you. You might be having a 2 to 3 hour interview with them, and then they might spend additional hour or two working on your case. Some homeopaths don't need that time, others do. But they put a lot of effort into that first case analysis because they're also thinking about backups and other things during that first case analysis. Think how much you'd be paying the regular medical doctor if you spent two, 3 hours with them. Anyway, but in the long run, the costs are much less. You know, as we all know, the cost of the remedies themselves is negligible. But the long run, your health, I mean, if you actually can find the right remedy, you're just not going to be sick all the time. You're not going to be having all these chronic health problems. I know other people in my family, not my immediate family, but relations who don't use homeopathy. Their children are really sick, having these chronic problems like asthma and, you know, all kinds of issues. Young children, it's really sad for me to see, and I wish they'd just listen and try homeopathy. Then their children wouldn't have these problems, and the adults as well. But just like with our economic system, people disagree, and sometimes they won't listen. And so, unfortunately, they can't benefit. because there is hope with homeopathy. Anyway, last month I also told you about my athlete's foot finally getting cured with homeopathy. And I want to just tell you that it continues and that it's almost gone now. I just am amazed. So I'm excited. For the first time in 5-6 years, I've been able to successfully treat my constitutional remedy. That my newer one I'm on has successfully treated probably the worst case of athlete's foot I've ever had, and I'm thrilled. I don't need to tell you all that you need to get out there and vote. Vote with your head and think about what's needed for this country and for the world and really for the planet, because the next few years are going to be difficult ones, and we really need a good leader. So before I move on to talk about today's show, which is an exciting one, let me just remind you, of course, the usual, to go to the ImpossibleCure.com website, because this show is really based on the book, Impossible Cure. And there at the website, you'll find the autism page. From the home page, you'll find a link to the archives of this entire show. And I do suggest you listen to these free radio shows. You'll learn a lot about homeopathy. Of course, the Cure Stories database, how to make single and bulk orders, referral lists to homeopaths, and you can always send me an email, Lansky@ImpossibleCure.com or alansky@autism1.org. I usually get back to people within a week or so. So, next month's show, before I move on to today's show, next month's show, I'm going to have a guest again. We're having two interview shows in a row, today and next month. Next month, I'm going to be interviewing the ever-bubbly and vivacious Dana Ullman, who's going to be talking about his book that came out last year called The Homeopathic Revolution. What is the subtitle thing? Is Why Celebrities and Cultural Heroes Choose Homeopathy. It's about basically why really famous people over the past 200 years use homeopathy. And it's really, there's so many interesting stories in that book. Let's see. And let's move on to today's show. Today's show, we're having an interview with another homeopath. He's a very popular one who has who arouses a lot of loyalty from his patients and his students. His name is Dr. Luke DeShepper. Dr. Luke, you remember I had John Melnichuk on in May. Oh, was it in June? I can't remember. I think it was June, maybe. And he's going to be speaking at next year's national conference. Well, Dr. Luke is also going to be speaking. He's going to be giving a whole day seminar on Friday and also speaking Saturday morning. Dr. Luke DeShepper, who has lots of degrees, he's an MD, a PhD, a homeopath, and an acupuncturist. He is one of the most foremost homeopaths in the world today, and he's a teacher. He lectures, and he is also one of the first integrated physicians, a Western medical doctor who then became an acupuncturist and later a homeopath. And he's found that over the years, he's basically honed in more and more and become mostly, or maybe perhaps exclusively, I believe, a homeopath. He was born in Belgium, and he was trained. His MD is in Belgium. And as I said, he slowly migrated into other forms of alternative medicine. He also did a neurology internship at the UCLA School of Medicine. Anyway, he is known for a lot of things. Besides teaching, he also has written 15 books. That's amazing. And really, in homeopathic circles, what he's known for is hewing to the line of following precisely Hahnemann's precepts. And especially the sixth edition of the Organon about using only only liquid dosing of remedies. And he sometimes gets into controversies with homeopaths because he believes you should only use liquid dosing, never use dry dosing, whereas most homeopaths use both. Let's see. What else can I tell you? Oh, the other thing about Dr. Lucas, he's that very active in humanitarian efforts, and he's always traveling around the world and teaching, especially in the third world, teaching and treating people about homeopathy. And his practice, he has just started up his practice again for a while. He was traveling a lot. But last fall, he opened up his practice again in Los Angeles. And you can find out all about him at drluke.com, drluc.com. So that's easy. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Dr. Luke, and we can have our conversation. Okay, hold on. Welcome, Dr. Luke.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. I know you're always so busy, so thanks for making time for being on this show. I always begin my interviews by asking the homeopaths about themselves, and you have a really interesting history because you started off as a doctor, then an acupuncturist, then a homeopath. I'm really curious what your journey to homeopathy was all about, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was a quick transformation from my medical doctor's degree. It only took me about 2 months in 1971 to realize that the allopathic way was not my way, that it really didn't really give me the solutions for my patients that I really wanted to see, that I really I saw quickly that all I was doing was really suppressing symptoms, dealing with symptoms, not really with the root of the disease. And I was not satisfied, so I went immediately to Holland and at the same time to Paris, to world cities where I could study traditional Chinese medicine. And actually at that point I was already introduced to homeopathy because it was also integrated in the program.
So
it was a quick transformation, and I never looked back, of course, because since then I have done nothing but studying homeopathy and applying it in the practice.
Do you still do Chinese medicine at all?
No, not really since about 1993, I would say. At that point, I was really treating patients both with traditional Chinese medicine and homeopathy. But certainly, I find it more efficient and certainly less time-consuming for the patient and less costly to really do only homeopathy. And it was very satisfactory because the advantage I see is that in comparison with traditional Chinese medicine, which I love because it's truly a true scientific method, that we can be more specific in homeopathy for any particular kind of disease that comes, and certainly for the vast majority of these children, autistic children, in which we see such a tremendous amount of different kind of pictures, of course. Certainly homeopathy is well versed to approach such children's cases.
So what percentage of your practice is autism now? I know that you're getting more and more kids in your practice.
Well, there's also certainly not one day that passes by that I not see an autistic children. It's certainly at least 50 or even like 60%, I would say, at this point, although I treat about anything as I'm used to in my practice. To me, in all honesty, there's no difference. When I was treating in the late 80s, beginning 90s, I was treating, I saw these children, the ADD, ADHD, OCD, as you know, all those children, the attention deficit disorder children. In my opinion, there is no difference. Many of those children would have been called ASD at this time. So basically, there is just a transference of name, and that's not really unusual that this happens in medical history, and even I would say in school systems where certain programs get just changed in name, but in reality there is no difference. The problem is still the same, the background is still the same, and it's one way of allopathy dealing with a mysterious disease, or a rather disease that they can't cope very well with, just as ASD at this point. to give it a new name. You know, you might think about chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome of 1981. Well, that is going out of vogue, and it kind of disappeared, yet it was replaced by fibromyalgia, which is basically nothing and the same. You know, and just giving it another name is, of course, not resolving the problem. It's just really postponing a solution and giving hope to people who now are diagnosed with a new disease. And here and now, whole new research can start, when in reality, really nothing has been done.
That's the beauty of homeopathy, because you can start treatment no matter what it is, even when you don't know what it is.
It is the beauty, because we don't really treat a name, as you understand. You know, we treat a person with a disease, if you want to call it a name. And now, again, what's in a name, for me, there is nothing. I really don't look at, even we talk about autistic children, I am against the name. For many, many reasons. I understand that sometimes a name needs to be given so that people can get the services in school and, you know, in psychology and so on and so on. But at the same time, it really puts people into a basket, and really it creates kind of a stigma on the family that they have a defective child. Yet, you know, you look at this and all these children have a different picture. They really need a different remedy most of the time, and even if they need the same remedy, they will never react in the same fashion. I mean, the management becomes really very important, and the interaction between the homeopath and the parents is really absolutely very necessary to communicate very well. But, you know, again, it really doesn't help classifying these children in that way. I always want to know when people come with autistic child, I really don't care about the name. I want to know who is your child, what particularly distinguishes your child from another, so I can match it, you know, to the picture that I really know from the homeopathic provings.
I totally agree with this thing, because even when we began with my son, it was very, you know, it was a long time ago, and people told us to avoid even getting a diagnosis like that. You know, it strikes such fear into the hearts of the parents. They become completely freaked out, and then that can, you know, just sort of compounds what's going on in the family.
Well, it compounds in many different ways. First of all, it compounds, you know, first of all, striking the fear in the parents, makes them anxious, nervous, and as we know, when feelings override, then the thinking stays away. And so, in other words, not always best decisions are taken at that point by the parents, and now they're more taken out of fear, which is always a bad approach. And not to mention, of course, that, you know, rightfully, parents often get overwhelmed by the task ahead, you know, 24-7, of course, without any doubt. But the more important thing about this fear, what you mentioned, is that if they want another child, which is usually the case also, that fear remains. It isn't resolved. And that is one of the greatest dangers, in my opinion, and that is still unknown totally in allopathy and even among most homeopaths, how the strong emotions felt by the mother intrauterine will be transferred to the unborn fetus, and that by itself creates a problem.
Well, why don't we talk now? I want to get into specifically about autism treatment. I have lots of questions, and... Well, why don't we just begin then with the family issues? A lot of homeopaths I've talked to feel that that the kids who've done the best in there with treatment have been the ones that are the least dysfunctional. That, you know, the family dynamic has a lot to do with how successful the treatment will go. And I'm just curious about, and I know you've talked about, like you say, in utero issues. You know, what you have to say about all those kinds of things.
Well, first of all, the children that indeed do the best is where both parents stay on the same page. There's no doubt about it. I cringe when I see parents fighting in front of me in the office while the child is listening, and so children, believe me, are even more sensitive than others. Thank God this does not happen too often. I must really commend most parents, you know, 95% of them are very dedicated. And really, you know, playing the role on the same page. And there is a danger, of course, also that there is a good cop, bad cop situation at home. I see that often too, where the mother is usually the one that is the bad cop because she is the one most with the child and needs to apply all the structure and the discipline, while daddy coming home from a day's work can be just sometimes gives in, you know, to the child. If the mother really had forbidden something, the child knows very quickly, I can go to daddy and get what I wanted. And that creates a tremendous amount of stress in the household. In other words, it's not unusual that parents, in the height of their passion and in the height of the stress, that they can turn on each other. It's really understandable. And that they start shouting at each other, it's all your fault, it's in your family, it's in your genes. And that, in no way, does help the task of the homeopath, trying to get a very good report from the parents. I mean, maybe really follow the treatment of children, of these children. We really need to get great communication, and we need to get a report from everybody who is involved with the child. That does not only mean the parents, certainly also the ABA specialist, the speech therapist, of course the school, the shadow at the school. The more information we get, the better we can judge how our treatment is working and how we need to adjust the treatment. Often the child behaves differently at school than at home, and that by itself, of course, is a special characteristic of some children, of course, that we need to give this children to a remedy to.
What's your procedure when you have a new patient come? Do you how do you have parents prepare for like that first appointment?
Well, I do send them a whole questionnaire about it. I must say, usually it's to some extent useful. Especially ask a timeline. I want to see, and I ask them about, by the way, the intrauterine story, which is the most important for me. But usually it's not really that much of a help. To some extent, I mean, I really do look at it, obviously, when people go out of their way, but I tell them to really describe the child to me, how they see their own child, not in comparison with anything else. I mean, usually the test results that I get from psychologists that they have done at school psychology are really of very little help. I mean, they're just a usual thing, very common. No peculiar things about their children. It's all common, the common diagnosis, which really doesn't help us at all determining a remedy. So for me, I had taken an hour and a half the time to tell me and ask the parents, you know, tell me precisely for your child, what's your first concern? And usually there's more than one. You know, we talk about behavior issues, we talk about speech problems, but I want to know what especially is the concern for their child. And then I want really examples, because those are really the most, indicating for me for a remedy. You know, what do you mean with, you know, when he has a temper tantrum? Why does he have one? What triggers it off? How does he behave? As you know, we need to get very specific details that are never really asked by any other doctor, because for them it doesn't really mean anything. Now, how does he do with music? How does he like animals? And so on and so on. How is he towards other children? Does he neglect them? Is he cruel to them? Does he hit them, scratches them? How is he towards strangers? All questions really, and many more, of course, that really really should be asked by a good homeopath, and that really make this child stand out and helps us in determining the right remedy for the children. It's not an easy task, as you might know, because parents often, I understand it completely, always tell me, you know, the first time often I hear, oh, he is such a good boy, and he is so intelligent, he is really, truly a good human being, and I believe all of it, except, of course, I see the child in front of me not speaking five words, the child scratches and hits the mother or the brother right in front of me, or there's a sexual act in front of me, you know, and so on and so on. And, you know, unfortunately, the parents need to realize that the rose-colored glasses must go off. You know, in their heart, they know it, of course. There's no doubt about it. And my empathy goes totally out to the parents. It's a terrible, tremendous task for them. But they must understand that we must look at the facts in that way. Now, we are not blaming anybody. That's sometimes misunderstood. You know, when I ask about intrauterine trauma, it is not to blame anybody, certainly not the mother or the father. I can call it like the Chinese medicine, you know, a noble misfortune that happens to all of us. But we need to know the facts, so in order we can determine really what we need to do for the child. And I know very few parents who would not give me the facts because they really love their children.
So you spoke, you really believe very strongly that the intrauterine trauma is causative. You feel that stronger than the vaccination?
Certainly. I actually believe we talk about the triggers now. I'm not, you know, we haven't even talked about the terrain that really should be discussed. But the triggers, indeed, the causality, the trigger on the right terrain, I mean, as usual, any disease, you know, even Pasteur said that the terrain, that the virus was nothing, the terrain is everything. But obviously we need to have both present. Certainly as a trigger, I believe that the intrauterine trauma is definitely more important than the vaccinations. For me, the vaccinations, you know, since we eliminated the mercury in 2003 for most of the vaccinations, except the flu vaccination now is one of them, certainly it's the amount of the vaccinations that's given to the children that is, to me, in my opinion, the wrong way. We know in homeopathy very well that we call it vaccinosis. You know, the amount of vaccinations given creates this, what we call the psychotic miasmatic situation, and Burnett, Compton Burnett, an old homeopath, a century ago, called it vaccinosis, and we only had a few vaccinations then. With the amount of vaccinations now, everything accelerates, and that's one of the greatest triggers in that way, okay? So, let's just say, if you would have a child with really a very small amount of autistic traits, as we can keep on giving vaccinations, the amount of vaccinations, and we see this often around 15 months, 16 months, now when we approach already 20 to 25 vaccinations, and we give another 7 shots at the same time, that all of a sudden the mother would say, I lost my child right there and then, which for them then, of course, now we talk about the MMR, even usually around that time too with other vaccinations, so that way the MMR was the culprit for the autistic children create autism. In my opinion, that's not true. It's the amount of vaccinations we know very well. It accelerates every situation, every autistic case, just like the psychotic miasm accelerates any other disease also. So that's different. For me, the intrauterine trauma is still mostly neglected. I'm teaching everywhere in the world to homeopaths, and it's in my latest book. It's still totally neglected, yet a very, very important factor. Okay. In allopathy, we really accept, that physical pain can be felt by the fetus, the unborn fetus.
If you could, I'm curious if you can give me some examples of the from your cases of the kinds of intrauterine trauma.
There's plenty, of course. I actually really have put 10 questions together for the parent and for the homeopath to be asking the parent so they have a good idea about any possible intrauterine trauma. But let's just ask start with the first question, and that would be, you know, how did you react in the moment you felt that you were pregnant, that you heard you were pregnant? Often it's the mother who hears it the first time that she is pregnant. And those reactions are very, very different. Anyone would hope we were very happy, and that can be. But often I hear, this was not the right time, it would interfere with my lifestyle, I'm just starting a new job, my marriage is not going too well, I have just too much stress right now, I don't think I can be a good mother, I use too many drugs, so I don't think I can be a good mother, and I can tell you another 100,000 answers to that really first question. You must understand that particular idea, that thought that was expressed, even if it's just for a day, even for a few days, you know, people always think, well, later I was very happy about it. But that by itself, there's no doubt about it, is already some kind of rejection towards the child. And that really is just the beginning of an example. I would say many other examples in the two most common emotions that the mother felt during the pregnancy are most important, that are the sense of abandonment and fright. Those two emotions, and there are plenty of course, other ones, but those two, especially worries and cares, I think about a parent who had maybe, you know, a mother who had already 2 or 3 miscarriages before she has this particular child, you know, now she's afraid of course that she's going to miscarry again, you know, or they had to wait such a long time with IVF and so on and so on, so that the whole pregnancy consists of worrying and cares about, is this going to go through or I'm going to miscarriage again? You see, we call these ailments from worries and cares. That, again, if that's present, usually it is present in such circumstances throughout the pregnancy, that you know, that the emotion of Kash must go over to the fetus, and there we have a child that will reflect the same picture as the mother did in her pregnancy, which is, of course, very helpful for us to find the remedy.
Well, isn't it true that this has always been true of pregnancy forever? So why now would this autism epidemic...
Sure, it has been present all the way. You know, maybe not so much, because if it would go back 100 years, we didn't have the medical interventions that we have right now. We didn't do ultrasounds left and right, or, we checked for genetic... We didn't know what happened in our pregnancy. So we don't have to go... We can't really go back about 80, 90 years, because we didn't have all that stuff.
Right.
But let's just say we do have it now. Maybe we'll talk about the last 50 years, maybe, or even less than that. So now we have it, and indeed we see an increase of autism without any doubt, I mean, really in the last decade even. So why it's really now happening is precisely because of the parents, both of them have probably in their particular, and that's really part of the background, what we call the genetic soil, or what we call our miasmatic background, that has been suppressed and not treated well all along. I mean, it's really... astonishing to me that there still can be a healthy child sometimes born, and I'm always happy to see it. But, you know, where, as we go on with time in this, even now and further in the future, with suppressive therapies, which we are doing all the way, you know, then we'll actually accelerate the progression from what we call psora to psychosis to syphilis. And autism is really nothing but a syphilitic expression. The syphilitic miasm has to be present in the family, and we always see it, then we understand why this now becomes much more of a problem. In other words, if the trigger was always present, that's one thing, but the trigger without the right terrain doesn't do anything. Okay, so we do, it's just a mistake of people thinking, and we do think that way often, no, all parasites, oh my God, that is so bad. Well, you know, half of the world lives with parasites in peace, because there is a balance in the whole system. It is when we basically change the terrain because of a trigger like strong emotions that we really have a problem. So you have to have both parts together, not just one. The trigger without the soil doesn't do anything. It's like the coals on a barbecue, okay? You have to light the fire, otherwise nothing happens. But the soil, therefore, is the most important, because without that, nothing will happen. And that is something that both parents, my opinion, before they would think about having children, which should be treated through a good homeopath to really create the best soil for their child coming. Same thing with TCM, with traditional Chinese medicine. We certainly can explain even autism through that very adequately and see what elements are really deficient. And that, by the way, the understanding, which I wish most then doctors would learn something of homeopathy, truly learning, or TCM, that they would not unnecessarily bombard these children with blood tests, hair analysis, chelation, and so on and so on, and diets that sometimes are absolutely overwhelming, without, you know, and basically imitating allopathy in that way by giving protocols that are not really individually directed to these children.
So I assume then, you know, you take... That's this intrauterine thing is part of the case.
Of course, it's part of the
case. And I mean, will you often treat based on that? Will you ever, let's say that the parent came in and said it was specifically after the DPT vaccine or whatever, will you ever do isopathic treatment, or you will never?
No, I will never do isopathy, because it's really not necessary. Isopathy is not homeopathy.
Right.
And I'm totally against it, just as Harman, Hering, and all the great homeopaths in the past were. If truly a vaccination is a layer, right, if it does create a layer, if it's truly a trigger,
yeah,
then we do have, as you know, we have at least 15 remedies, and many black type, many very strongly indicated remedies, that we can use as long as the total picture is fitting the remedy. I mean, doing isopathy is, again, just doing like allopathy. You're approaching one symptom, you're approaching one trigger, one symptom, and therefore it's not homeopathy. You're just, remember, you're treating the food of a person instead of the whole person.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, I'm only asking because I know a lot of people are...
Yeah, of course they do, and you know what happens is this, that You know, they hear it from one parent, you know, often, oh my God, that makes such a bit of a difference. You know, this DPT homeopathically given. First of all, I always ask those homeopaths who do this, where are the proving symptoms of DPT? Now, it's not existing, so we sin against everything what we do in homeopathy. Number two, it certainly can happen in one or two cases of 100 that there was a good reaction, and therefore everybody else tries to do it without...
No, you should never do that. That's crazy.
No, but it did happen that way.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, and I know it.
Some people do it immediately, unfortunately. They start by giving all the vaccines, which I can't even believe they do.
Well, of course, that is indeed another thing that, you know, when people ask me, should we replace the vaccination now with Nozort, and that's absolutely no for to me also.
But of course, now, let's say in my son's case, a Nozort was curative, and, you know, in his case, carcinosin. And I've heard you say you don't believe in using in the Nozodes, even if they're proven, even if they're...
I'm not sure where you heard that.
On the blog, that you don't like using the Nozodes as, you know, a constant...
I use the Nozodes for sure as a very important part of treatment. I mean, I'm not sure where you would read this or when you would even think that, but let me explain it to you.
Okay.
But I'm against it, and even when I read about your case there of your son Max, is that these Nozodes are given daily for months and months, and I can tell you one thing, I can have seen those children totally destroyed by it, okay, in my office coming this way. That is the danger. You know, the Nozodes are extremely, as you understand, very deep working remedies. They are absolutely the golden keys in many of our treatments, so I mean, we could not really treat people homeopathically well if we didn't have them. But what I'm against it is definitely that they're used arbitrarily, just, you know, for, because let's just say even if you're, you know, when your son is cured by carcinosin, the problem with that is that people read such things and that homeopath then just start giving carcinosin to everybody.
No, I agree
and
with you.
And believe me, I have seen it. So it's, I'm
I
not,
know, and that's the first thing I tell people: don't give your kid carcinosin. That's not the right remedy. No,
but see, but so, like I said, am I for Nozodes? Of course. And I mean, we really, if you read my books, you know, there's 13 indications for Nozodes. So am I a believer in it? Of course I am. But it should be very properly used, and too many times homeopaths use them in a totally inappropriate way for far too long, months at a time, even in liquid doses, and that's really the greatest danger, is that if the child did not have that miasm at that point, or the person, an adult or a child, that you're going to create it or wake up a miasm, and that's another discussion that we can have.
Yeah. No. Well, since then, of course, I didn't treat my son myself, but I know that you shouldn't use an LM dose every day, only as needed. So,
Well, forget LMs, you know, I mean, that's another thing that I have known the LMs for many, many long time, probably before most of the homeopaths, and now I can see that they finally come to it and think that LM potencies are just, you know, very easy and that they are never aggravated and they're given every day. I mean, to me, the biggest mistakes in homeopathy right now, it's not so much finding the remedy, which by itself is a different task, but management is absolutely horrible throughout the world, I must say.
So I want let's move away from all that now, because
yes, to homeopathic.
But let's talk about, like, you know, these parents will come into you taking everything under the sun, all these supplements, diets, chelation, all these, you know, many things. What do you tell them? How do you sort that out for them?
And there's no doubt that all of those parents have already done all those things before they come to me. And I would say, unfortunately, because they already have given a lot of money out, a lot of hope, and with really, most of the time, very few results, I may say, in general. Otherwise, they wouldn't come to me to start with. You know, but the way we have to approach it at that point is, I mean, I always say to them, and the moment I give the first remedy, only one remedy, do not change anything else, because that would be foolish for my part, is to take away 10 different things, and, you know, because at that point, how would I know, or the parents, how the child will react towards my remedy if I change about 10 different things. So I only want to change one thing, which is, of course, the remedy. Now one remedy is given, the child is already is in a particularly baseline situation, so it's easy for us to see when we see changes within the next couple of weeks or whenever it happens that it's due to the remedy and not anything else that we changed. Of course, at the same time, I tell them not to start adding other things or other kind of treatments, be it acupuncture, being it whatever chelation or anything else, if it hasn't started yet. So that's just common sense. Later, of course, I can see, I mean, think about this, children have all digestive problems and malabsorption problems. Yet, it's not an exception, rather the rule, that most of these children coming to me have 30, 40 supplements taking every day. I really look at that and think, but how do you think that children with malabsorption problems, how much of this 30, 40 supplements are they going to absorb? Not even an adult, a normal adult will absorb even half of it. So to me, that becomes part of the problem. And for a homeopath, the task can become a problem because often I found out that, you know, they added a new supplement and basically the child started reacting towards it. And then the remedy gets blamed. So it becomes a very difficult road for us to understand what's really going on. And that's why I'm pertinent about it. Now, I don't change anything in the beginning. It's once I start and we see the progress of the remedy, then, we really take away what's really not necessary, and that's quite a bit.
It's so difficult because these parents are so freaked out, and they're always saying, but they always want to try something as soon as possible to get it over with as soon as, you know.
No, I agree. Impatience is the worst of all of it, okay? Impatience of the parents, and if then the homeopath is impatient on the top of it, that becomes a catastrophe, I can tell you that right away.
Although I'm not a practicing homeopathy and I don't treat it, but people write to me every day, right? And they say, what do? I want to try chelation and I want to do this, I want to do that. I just, I tell them exactly what you said,
I totally understand, believe me. And what the problem with this is that homeopathy, as you understand, has to not just work on the symptoms. It has to work on the genetic background. It has to change the genetic background. This is the process, when the child comes to you when it's 5, 6 years old. This is already a process that, as I mentioned before, has even started intrauterine. Okay, we're having a child that obviously inherited some of both sides, the genetic background, and we actually need to change it and correct it. That is not done overnight. It is interesting to me that children come to me, they have had 4 years speech therapy, 4 years ABA therapy, and still hardly function. But then expect from me that in the next 2 months, the child will behave perfectly and speak perfectly. Now, so the patience is very thin. And by the way, even if that happens sometimes, then it's just kind of normal. I'm used to this kind of reactions. But I must say, that's why I really teach the parents. That's our duty, really, is to inform them in the right way. I'm writing a book about it right now. It's going to take me probably another year before it's ready. But I want to teach them, and I have lessons in homeopathy on my website where the patient can really check and understand what they can expect and what they should expect of the homeopathic treatment. That gives them a little bit more of an introduction. The rest, like you say, about chelation, about all the other therapies that are around there, especially these treatments, and as I know that subject very well. I wrote a book about it in 1985, actually, that goes way back, and I did all those treatments and basically the tests and everything that what them doctors do now, I did 25 years ago, but I always, and that's the difference, I always did also TCM at that point. I always had a root treatment, as I would call it, at the same time. So I do understand all those testing results. I also know that it's, for me, a rather superficial treatment, and it can give some wow moments, as parents call it. But then, and unfortunately, the wall moment does not really continues. It's short living, precisely because it's really treating more of the vita, with more the superficial symptoms, and not really totally the whole totality of the child that really is presented to us.
So we have about 5-10 more minutes.
Okay.
What would you say are the ingredients of like, if you, I would be also interesting to hear about some of your successful cases, what would you say is the ingredient, that, can you see anything that separates the successful ones from the ones that haven't done as well?
But the ingredients, well, there's very many fold, by the way. You know, first of all, it's the home we start in the first place, right? If anything goes wrong, I always blame myself first to some extent. I always want to make sure I have not, left any stone untouched, so to speak. That's why really part of it is I really teach my patients to be in great communication with me. I probably do, and you know, I have every day 3 hours emails, you know, just from pure communication, daily communication with my patients, which is entirely free between consults, by the way. That is for me an essence, because without that, I would have lost many of these children already. You know, often I even have to say sometimes to parents, you have to email me every day, actually in the next weeks.
I don't know how you deal with all that.
I'm probably the only dummy, because I haven't heard any homeopath in the world doing this. But yet, I know without that I would have lost half of it, and now they are successful. That is the difference. You must understand, Amy, that how can we put it on parents to understand exactly what we need to see in homeopathy when many homeopaths in the world don't even understand it? Okay, so for me, it is our duty to keep their hands, hold their hands, so to speak, if necessary. One need more, you know, but it's always my duty, and it's always, and always what I always do is to really teach in the beginning very quickly, this is what you look for, what are the indicators that you should repeat the remedy, and so on. Certain remedies like, you know, tarantula, lachesis, they are very fast-working remedies, very fiery remedies, don't need to be repeated too often or you get great aggravations. With those children, I definitely hold the hands of the parents a little longer, a little bit more often, and that way I can keep them. And now, NBC, if you talk about success, you know, we need to also always determine what does that mean, you know, the definition of success. I don't like the word recovery. Recovery it means like, what does that mean? You know, that you have done a little bit of toward the child. I mean, I'm talking about a cure, not recovery.
That's why I called my book Impossible Cure.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's what we're going for, not just getting.
Yeah, know. Recovery doesn't mean anything, because as you understand too, you have seen it on TV and everything like this. My child has recovered, but when you then go into detail, it really means, well, the child is behaving a little bit better, still doesn't speak very well, still is awkward in social situations. You know, to me that's not the cure. That's, you know, if you call it recovery, I'm against the word recovery. Let's put it that way. So for me, what I need to see, and patients, of course, always ask you, when is my child going to be cured? That's really asking, like, do you have a crystal ball? You can look at it for the future. Okay, so I tell patients that's not the way we want to look at it. What we want to look at it is, like, you have to look back every month in our treatment and see, did we make any progression, and true progression, not suppression, true progression. And, you know, any good homeopath knows what that means. You know, we know about the observations of hearings, then we know about the picture has to come back to where it was before. And I mean, that's another thing. The original picture, of course, has to come back without new symptoms. So, you know, for us, we have to continuously ask ourselves that, so that we know we truly are proceeding with a true cure. When the true cure completely will be done, that is very, that's different from child to child. I mean, it's like saying, how do I know the child in 1 month from now will not get a very strong acute disease with which you spent the chronic disease? How do I know that? Because, you know, I can't. I can't predict those things. But certainly we know that at such points we need to postpone, a chronic treatment, and it will stop, you know, the progress of the child to some extent at that point, you know, delay it, let's put it this way, not stopping but delaying it. So we can't predict the future, but what we can do is look back and say, are we making progress? Are we, you know, having gains in the child? True gains, not suppressive gains. You know, not letting the child sleep because we give it a sleeping pill. That's called suppression, not a cure.
Right.
So those are the things a good homeopath should look for, and he should educate the parents that way.
Have you found it better if you can treat the parents as well?
There's no doubt about that. In the first place, the mother, because the mother usually bears the whole brunt of it. And very often I have seen, and that's why I keep their hands so often, that's another reason, is that the mother loses it, and totally understandable, you know, gets in a CPS state or whatever, gets overwhelmed, burned out, because she has not because the child needed it, because she needs a remedy. That's the big difference.
Yeah.
And you can understand how, now you understand how difficult it can become for us, because when we see that the child aggravated on the remedy, the mother is totally in an aggravated state, and by aggravating her child, she thinks, I need to give it either more, this remedy, or the remedy is not working. And none of the two is correct. It's, you know, she needs a remedy. The child did not need the remedy at that point.
Have you had any success in treating older autistic kids who come to you when they're like, you know, teenagers or older?
Yeah, yeah. Let me say that breaks my heart. Let me say that right away. I have seen 24-year-old ones, you know, 25-year-old ones, and still see them probably sometimes even worse than a 4-year-old child. You know, have to come with both parents. There is no difference. The only difference is, of course, that we already have a situation, we call it a layer, that's already a lot longer present. Puberty already has set in, obviously, and we know puberty always makes the situation worse because it just fires up the miasm in every way. So it breaks my heart simply for thinking about the epidemic we're having right now and thinking that maybe 10, 15 years from now, I don't know how the world will deal with it. In all honesty, I don't even know how the world will deal with it at this point because it's definitely, in my opinion, going to break the, you know, the school system, family system, unfortunately, the social system, and also the medical system. Maybe that's the only good part of it, because you know, people, I mean, now doctors are going to have to face the reality that, think about it, pediatricians right now diagnose the disease, which, you know, even my grandmother can do at this point, but then say, well, go away, and hopefully he grows out of it and deal with it, and that's about it. You know, but mothers are fighters. And for these children, we're talking about older people. Mothers fight for their children, rightfully, and will ask questions and solutions. And I think that will change. That's the only good part I see, that it will change. Now, it has to change the medical system, and hopefully not in the sense of bringing more psychodynamic drugs which suppress the emotions or will just aim at certain characteristics of the child, be it violence or whatever it is, you know, to suppress it with long-term bad effects of those drugs, and hopefully that's not the way it's going to be going.
So we're really out of time. I'm going to ask one more question, which is if there's a message you want to give these parents, what would it be?
It would certainly would be to really, don't believe my words, just research it. Now, I would say to them, read up on homeopathy, read about TCM, you know, read true curing principles about any medical modality. You know, what are we really doing? You know, are the things we are doing really helpful? And I mean in a really curative way, and therefore we need to try to define this. And again, read about, you know, the lessons I have for free on my website. So certainly question your doctors. Now, if it makes sense, go for it. If it doesn't make sense, don't do it. You know, don't do it because one child was doing well with this one supplement, and now everybody wants to do that supplement, and of course then it doesn't go for the 99 other percent. Just don't do such thing. Research it. If it makes sense, buy it. And I'm sure the one thing I want to tell them, to all the parents, they are my heroes. The unsung heroes are the mothers of these children, because they really do suffer with the child more than anybody else.
It's true. It's true. And that's why I wrote my book, too. I just wanted to help other people. So that's all we can do, you know. And I really appreciate what you've done for this population. I don't know how you're doing all these things, writing your books and...
Well, it's about 24 hours in a day, and I am really... I like it to use all 24 hours, let's put it this way.
Well, you need your sleep, too, you know, Dr. Luke.
Well, I wish I could just let it go. I haven't been able to do that yet. But I'm trying to, but, you know, even my sleep, I dream about my work. So I guess somewhere I get all the information what I need to get then.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank it was you. My pleasure. And I wish to all the parents and to all my wonderful children, I wish them all the best.
Okay, why don't you stay on the line? I'm going to pause this again.
No.
Hold on.
Wow, well, we really had a long show today. That's about all we have time for, and I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you didn't have any trouble with Dr. Luke's accent, but he had a lot of interesting things to say, didn't he? So Just want to finish up again by reminding you to go to impossiblecure.com. Also remind you to support the National Center for Homeopathy and find out all about it at nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. And also you can join the homeopathy and SN. It's homeopathy-and-SN at yahoogroups.com discussion group. And Dr. Luke's website, drluke.com. So that's about it. And remember, there is hope with homeopathy.